It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the State Department of Labor and Industry, manufacturing jobs in the Pittsburgh region dropped by about 2% over the past 12 months. But the good news is there's a portion of the overall manufacturing sector where investment is increasing, and that's where manufacturing and robotics intersect. Joining us in studio is Byron Clayton. He's the CEO of Pittsburgh-based Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing. Byron, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, and thank you, sir. So right now, 2019, give us a sense of what is the role of robotics in manufacturing. What does it look like on the factory floor, even?
Well, the role of robotics in manufacturing is all about making better products at lower cost. What we've learned from the past is those companies and those countries that do that, they pull market demand, which means the world buys those products, correct? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're doing. It's all about the opportunities to make better products, lower costs, pull market demand, and make a brighter future for U.S. manufacturers and workers.
So who or what is actually making the products? Machines with human supervisors? And I know it'll vary from company to company, sector to sector, but...
Well, it's technology and people. So people talk a lot about the new technologies and how fast they're coming and how they're converging on each other. But what's really important to understand is that it's all about the talent. Technology doesn't work without talent and people. And so people and technology, they have to work together. So who's making the products and these better products at lower cost? People and technology working together.
Are any Pittsburgh companies doing it really well?
Oh, we have over 60 robotics companies here. That's one reason why it's so important for ARM to be here in Pittsburgh. There is an innovation cluster here around robotics, and it's all types of robotics, not just for manufacturing, but for military applications, space applications, service applications. So there's a lot going on here. We're focused on manufacturing, but there are overlaps with all the other things that go on here in Pittsburgh.
You mentioned 60 robotics companies. So what is ARM's role? Is it like a conduit or what?
Well, our specific role is to really try and de-risk robotics. So the idea is there's a lot of innovation that goes on with technology in general, just not robotics, that doesn't seem to make it out of the laboratory. What we're focused on is making sure and doing the types of research and applied research that helps transition that technology to the factory floor. And the same thing goes with talent development. So when I talked about the fact that technology doesn't work without talent, if we are advancing technology and getting it to the floor, it doesn't make it there and it doesn't thrive without the talent. So part of what we do is also work with developing innovative workforce programs so that we can train up the workforce to adopt these kind of technologies.
Just last month, a representative from the Allegheny Conference on Community Development was on the program, and it was ranking IT and robotics and manufacturing among the region's top growth opportunities, investment opportunities. And of course, manufacturing has been the backbone of the region's economy for decades. How would you evaluate manufacturing here?
Well, there's a manufacturing renaissance going on here in the U.S. in general. When you look at all the factors that go into manufacturing, this is not just labor costs, but energy costs, productivity, those types of things. The U.S. remains one of the best places to manufacture in the world. And in fact, we're gaining. Now, whereas we've lost a lot of industries, we've lost a lot of jobs, we're still doing really well and we're doing better. And so, again, it brings up so many different opportunities here. There's this renaissance going on, and it's up to us to make sure that we're accelerating that renaissance.
You mentioned gaining. Are we gaining in terms of playing catch up or gaining and forging ahead?
It depends on the industry, right? So we have lost some industries, and in those industries, we need to play catch up. So the idea is we need to bring those industries back. And I'm sure you've heard about reshoring jobs.
Right.
We need to continue to reshore jobs. There are other areas like artificial intelligence which is which is part of the future of manufacturing. We are amazingly adept at creating those kind of innovations, especially here in Pittsburgh with Carnegie Mellon's work with artificial intelligence. So there we're ahead, and our mission is to not only remain ahead, but to create some distance between us and other competitors.
So where are we lagging behind, maybe?
The biggest place we're lagging behind is in the implementation of technology. And this goes back to the 70s. That's when we first saw it. We've always been the most innovative country in the world. That hasn't changed. What started to change in the 70s is when other countries started to implement some of the things that we had created here. When you think about lean manufacturing and even robotics, those things were actually invented here, but they were implemented in other countries and through practice were made better, which led to making better products at lower cost, which was the beginning of a lot of the manufacturing shifts that we saw in the 70s and 80s.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Byron Clayton. He's CEO of Pittsburgh-based Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing. Your company's getting a new home, shifting from the Lawrenceville area to Mill 19, part of Hazelwood Green Development. When's the big move?
So the big move is this month. I can't give you a specific date because we're working a lot of the details out right now, but we're ready to go.
What will this new facility allow you to do that maybe you can't now?
Well, it gives us the space that we need to actually start to put robotics in. Part of what we're going to do in the facility is de-risk robotics. So we've just kicked off an effort where we're looking locally for manufacturing partners that have manufacturing challenges that they need to solve. If this is something that we can solve with advanced robotics, we actually want to replicate one or more of their work cells at Mill 19, integrate the new technologies, prove it out, and then pick it up and take it to their manufacturing facility and put it right on their floor.
Two-part question. Is Pittsburgh the right place for you? And you mentioned that U.S. has always been a leader in innovation. So if we're a leader in innovation and Pittsburgh is part of that, what are we missing here?
Well, there was a Brookings study a couple of years ago. I want to say it was the fall of 2017. And they really put their finger on it. We are great at innovating here, especially in Pittsburgh. If you look at CMU Pitt, the 80 some odd universities and community colleges here, we're great at innovating. What we haven't done as good of a job as we should have is actually implementing that technology so that you can see it in growing companies who are manufacturing products using the same innovations that we're creating.
Do you find here or nationally resistance, opposition to robotics, that it's going to take away jobs, replace workers?
Of course. And the truth is, it does. Robotics and automation and advanced technology, there are certain jobs that are going to go away. But here's the thing. Those jobs are going to go away anyway because we're in a global competition. And in order for us to compete, we have to become more productive. So on the one end, some of those, dirty, dull, and dangerous jobs, they're going to go away. However, it creates so many more opportunities for people. And here's the good news. It doesn't require that you have a PhD or even a bachelor's degree to take advantage of some of these new opportunities that are coming. Community college, 2-year degrees, technical schools. And the more we push some of these technologies down into high schools, even high school diplomas, coming out of high school, you'll be able to take advantage of some of these technology opportunities that are happening.
So do you anticipate a net jobs gain, a net loss, maybe a plateauing, but with different jobs?
If you look at all the studies around the world, there's a net jobs gain, but it's a reshuffling of jobs. That's what's coming. And that can be painful, and we understand that, which is exactly why part of what we do, in fact, a big part of what we do, is really look at advancing the workforce itself. So coming up with innovative career pathways to help regular people get some of these great jobs that are appearing.
Is that the future workforce or people currently in the workforce, and what can we do for them?
It's both. So incumbent workers, So what we want to do is incumbent workers have existing skill sets that can transfer quite nicely. Plus, if you have somebody that comes to work, you know, they show up to work, they're hard workers, you know, they have initiative. Those are the kind of skills that you want for these new technologies, because they're going to continue to move and change and grow. So you need people that can move and change and grow with it. So incumbent workers are very important to the workforce.
All right, we have about a minute and a half left. What's next for your company, for ARM?
Well, the biggest thing is to make to move. Okay. We've got to get into the new facility. We're going to do a lot more in terms of actually transitioning some of this technology to the factory floor. As you know, we fund different projects around the country. So we're based here in Pittsburgh, but we are a national organization. So we're going to fund more projects. We have about 20 projects currently, and this is on the workforce side and the technology side. But by the end of the year, we'll have closer to 40, and that's going to continue to grow.
All right. In a few sentences, what will you and others be doing in 5 to 10 years in the manufacturing sector that right now might be an idea, a hope, an aspiration?
I think the biggest thing is we're going to watch this development of technology and talent working together. A lot of the fears that exist today in terms of robotics and other kinds of technology taking jobs, I think within that time frame you're talking about, you're going to see that disappear, and you're going to see people and technology and machines working together and working as a team and watching our country, and specifically our middle class, grow and our country thrive because of it.
Byron Clayton is CEO of Pittsburgh-based Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been my pleasure.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Local research shows that only 50% of eligible Pennsylvanians are receiving nutritional assistance during the critical phase of development. This includes pregnant women, breastfeeding mothers, and kids up to age 5. We'll ask why. And swimming pools have started opening across the region for the summer, but a new report by the Tribune Review shows a number of health violations and oversights at local public pools and spray parks. To find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence, check out our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, writer Valerie Solanas shoots artist Andy Warhol in 1968. Solanas met Warhol in New York City, where she asked him to produce a play she'd written. She said the Pittsburgh native lost her work, and after another similar situation having to do with intellectual property and Warhol, she purchased a gun and went to a studio, The Factory. She fired 3 shots, missing Warhol with the first 2 and wounding him with the 3rd. She turned herself into police. Solanas is best known for writing the Scum Manifesto, and her story was recently featured on the FX program American Horror Story. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The main goal of the Advanced Leadership Initiative is to build a pipeline of African-American executive leaders within the region. As 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports, many of Pittsburgh's CEOs have developed an educational program geared towards lessening the achievement gap for those aspiring to reach the C-suite.
The Advanced Leadership Initiative, informally known as TALI, launched in 2018 and started making significant pathways for future corporate CEOs by grooming professionals to take the next step of leadership. Evan Frazier is Senior Vice President of Community Affairs for Highmark Health and TALI's founding director.
The vision is to invest in 20 to 25 high-potential African-Americans every year, and that will then help to build the pipeline that we see is needed.
In partnership with Carnegie Mellon University's Tapper School of Business, a group of cohorts go through the Executive Leadership Academy, a rigorous 7-month training program to help participants maximize their potential in the Pittsburgh marketplace.
They help to create a world-class executive education curriculum that weaves in 3 parts, management, leadership types of things with finance woven into it, along with how does diversity play itself out and helping giving people an understanding of how do you navigate, you know, implicit bias.
In addition to learning about successful upper management business practices, Frazier also says some tricks of the trade are woven into the training as well.
Each member of the cohort have their own executive coach. Each person will also receive their own executive mentor. If you don't have a sponsor, there's certain levels of management you're not getting into. You have to be sponsored into it. And so we recognize that.
When you get into corporate America, there are nuances that are necessary for individuals to recognize and to be aware of that help them to prepare for those C-suite positions.
Marcia Jones, Executive Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer of PNC and Executive Leadership Academy co-chair, says it's imperative for members of the cohort to receive preparation from CEOs themselves.
It is incumbent upon us as corporation to be able to create those kinds of opportunities for them.
She says retention of corporate leaders is key, and the initiative helps foster diverse relationships within the region. She points to the program's unique qualities.
There is not anything like it in the country, and yet we believe that there are a number of other cities that will probably imitate it because it is needed. And it can brand Pittsburgh as a very innovative type of city that many individuals would want to be able to come and become part of.
As the inaugural class of cohorts wraps up this July, participants will be receiving certifications from both TALI and CMU. But TALI founding co-chair and Randall Industries CEO Greg Spencer says the program is already paying dividends.
There were some that will be promoted. There's some that have been promoted already.
Spencer stresses that the program is geared toward diversifying the city and region's corporate sector, but is also about deepening TALI alums' roots in Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania.
One of the things that's important for us is to keep them in this region, and they will stay in this region if they see the opportunities. And so the key for us is to help identify opportunities in the region. We have to look at everything here as a community asset.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, provides food assistance to pregnant women, breastfeeding mothers, and kids up to age 5. The aim is to provide a solid nutritional foundation to children during critical stages of development. But recent analysis by the Pittsburgh-based Jewish Healthcare Foundation finds that just 50% of eligible Pennsylvanians receive this assistance. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden spoke with the foundation's Hanifa Nachidiowa to discuss why more people won't participate.
In Pennsylvania, WIC enrollment has declined over the past decade. Why is that bad for the program's funding?
It's not just Pennsylvania, Sarah. It's national, but it's bad for Pennsylvania because funding comes from the United States Department of Agriculture down to the state, and funding is dependent on level of participation. That means if our participation is dropping, then the federal government funding that comes to the state is also dropping, which affects the program, and eventually it causes a catch-22 situation where if we have less funding, then it also affects further enrollment. It keeps declining over the years.
Do we know why WIC enrollment is down?
There is no clear-cut answer for why WIC enrollment is down, but when we look deep into the entire details or the details of what surrounds WIC. It has been highly stigmatized, the messaging, the branding, and all that. It is associated with stigma when you say it's a program for poor people. But I don't necessarily have to be poor to qualify for WIC. Any mother is eligible for WIC if I'm eligible for Medicaid.
That was something I didn't realize, was that people who are eligible for Medicaid are also eligible for WIC.
And that's the basis upon which many states are doing better than Pennsylvania. Now that they know that if I'm eligible for Medicaid and SNAP, I'm equally eligible for WIC. So they use that as a pathway. If I'm going for Medicaid enrollment, they use that as a pathway to refer me to WIC and to make sure that I enroll for WIC automatically. Plus, I don't have to be just a biological mother for me to access WIC for my children. I can be the father, I can be the grandfather, I can be the foster parent, I can be the caregiver of that child, and I can go to the WIC office and access those services.
So as you know, Allegheny County has some pretty bleak stats when it comes to both infant and maternal mortality rates, especially for women of color. Do you see WIC as part of the solution for that?
So over the past couple of years, we have been digging deep into what can be done actually to address that. And it's heartbreaking to see that actually while other countries are doing better in terms of maternal and child health outcomes, United States is getting worse. So the best program we found was the WIC program. We have evidence through this research that we did. We found evidence to prove that the WIC program actually improves infant health outcomes, but nothing around maternal health outcomes. But we understand that the WIC program actually channels through the mother to reach the child. If I am the mother and the WIC program is actually is focusing on me, that means I have access to everything I need to be healthy for my baby and for my family. And we believe WIC can do that.
Well, Hanifa, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome, Sarah. Thank you so much for making time for this.
That was Hanifa Nachidiowa, Global Health Associate for the Jewish Healthcare Foundation, speaking with WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden. And Sarah joins us in the studio now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
Sarah, we heard in your conversation that some states are doing better than Pennsylvania to get eligible individuals to participate in the WIC program. Just 1 in 2 eligible Pennsylvanians participating in WIC. Is that number pretty consistent across the state? Some areas doing better than others?
Well, we don't have, at least my understanding is there isn't county by county data, or at least there wasn't in the white paper. But there are some organizations within Pennsylvania that are doing better than others. For example, the Maternal and Family Health Services in Scranton does a really nice job, according to this white paper, of using WIC in tandem with other services like addiction treatment, maternal health care, breastfeeding. So because, you know, WIC in a silo can only do so much, but when you have it in tandem with other services, you know, the impact can be greater.
So other organizations could be doing the same. How are they chosen?
Yeah. So WIC is a federal program.
Right.
Then goes to, I believe it's the Department of Health, and then the state government chooses nonprofits. So sometimes it's also county health departments to disperse the funding. And that's how the program is set up. So the quality of the WIC program is directly tied to like the individual nonprofits that get these contracts.
How important is it for pregnant women, when they are pregnant, to start receiving the nutritional assistance so that their baby, when born, has a better chance to have a healthier life?
Well, we know that, during pregnancy and then early childhood development, I mean, it's just critical, incredibly critical time for brain and nutritional development for anybody. You really need a good, healthy start within the first 5 years,
And it helps the baby get on the right track.
Helps the baby get on the right track. The brain development is just incredible within the first 5 years, so it's very important.
And very briefly, what is the Jewish Healthcare Foundation doing with this information? Are they providing it to organizations to get them to do a better job, or what?
Yeah, they have start their own initiatives and they're trying to spread the word. They've made recommendations to the state government because funding is dependent on enrollment. They're recommending that the state government increase funding to this federal program to just get more people, because like you said, only one in two Pennsylvanians that are eligible for WIC are getting WIC, and they'd like to see those numbers go up.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Swimming pools across western Pennsylvania are beginning to open for the summer season. But before you jump into that inviting water, you might want to listen to this conversation and read an investigative report by our next guests. Jamie Martinez and Nicole Brambilla are reporters for the Tribune Review. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
So your report found disparities in oversight between how the state and individual counties measure pool health. That includes monthly water logs, electrical inspections, bacteria measurements. What did you find? We'll start with you, Nicole.
I guess the most glaring thing that we found was the difference in oversight. Westmoreland County doesn't have a public health department, and Allegheny County does, and turns out that makes all the difference in the world. We found some pools, in fact, one in Westmoreland County that hadn't been inspected since 2012.
Hmm.
Yeah, and the reason that's important, many of the pool managers and operators who we spoke to are pretty diligent about keeping on top of those inspections, doing them hourly, sending samples out weekly. But if no one's looking over your shoulder to make sure things are going well or catching mistakes here and there, that could lead to problems down the road.
The other thing, too, is, if I can just jump in here, Kevin, is that there's no way to independently check it. You can go to Allegheny County's health department and look for your pool. You can also go to our website and look. We've aggregated all the information, and it's searchable. You can search by street name or by city pool or neighborhood. But there's no way to independently verify that all the things that are supposed to be done are actually being done. And the state can't verify it either.
You picked those two counties, Allegheny and Westmoreland, because of different things. Westmoreland does not have a health department, and whereas Allegheny County does. And so does Allegheny County's health department do inspections on behalf of the state? How does that work?
Yeah, so in counties where there is a local health department, they essentially assume the role of state inspections. And in some cases, like Allegheny County, their regulations might be stricter. Pools in Allegheny County are inspected annually, sometimes more. And all of that information is easily available through the county. Whereas in Westmoreland, where there isn't a local health department, the state is supposed to be coming in and doing that. In some cases, it's not clear whether or not that oversight is actually happening.
Like one of the pools in La Trobe, for example, Rogers McFeely Memorial Pool, has not been inspected in 7 years by the state. We went and visited. We have every reason to believe that they're taking care of the pool like they're supposed to. But unless you have the mettle to check and go to the state and start digging and getting these questions, there's no way to know for sure. And the public is essentially trusting that it's being done. I mean, we saw some studies that showed that they rarely even ask for, and most of the pool managers we spoke to said that nobody ever asks us about the testing.
Nobody asked us. Was the pool manager, pool operator, the one that you mentioned, Rogers McFeely, surprised that it hadn't been? And why would that person be surprised that it had not been inspected for all that time?
He had been. And in fact, so one of the state regulations is that you have to test for bacteria to make sure there's not nasty things in the water at least once a week. And they had been asking the people who conduct the lab, you know, why hasn't the state come out? Why hasn't the state come out? They were fully aware that the state hadn't come out since 2012. And some of the things that we had been hearing is that they came out pretty regularly, not every year, but every couple of years. So it's distressing to them, if for no other reason, that people are going to read our report, they're going to hear your program, and they're going to think that something is wrong. This is the public might think that something is wrong because the pool hasn't been inspected since 2012.
And if I can jump in, if you are concerned about the status of your pool, talk to your lifeguards, talk to your pool managers. The pools that we visited, everyone was more than happy to explain to us, show us how they're testing, show us their records. They're supposed to keep them. That is a state requirement that those records are available should anyone ask or be looking for them. So just ask, and they should be able to explain it to you and show everything to you.
So who's doing it right? What pools are doing it right?
Well, I met with folks from the county and from the city. they took me on a tour of South Park Pool, showed me how they keep the wave pool in check. I visited Shenley Pool, talked to one of the pool managers out there. He showed me how they filter the water, do double filtration. The good news is in Allegheny County, when there are problems, and there are problems, there's swimming pools, they generally get caught and corrected.
Mm-hmm. So what is required now of pool operators? Has it changed? And whether these pools are publicly owned, like city pools, county pools, municipal, or even run by schools or private clubs, what's required? What are the basics?
They're supposed to be checking the water minimally twice a day, and they're supposed to be turning over, based on the size of the pool, turning over the water so that the water in one area of the pool isn't clean, while the other part of the water, which hasn't been turned over yet, is dirty. So there's requirements on how frequently the whole pool is turned over and cleaned. And then they're supposed to do these weekly bacteriological tests to see what, if anything, is in the water. And those reports at one time were supposed to be sent into the state, but the state stopped requiring it. So not only are they not doing annual inspections, but the state isn't even looking at the documentation.
And your question brings up an interesting point. Is it just pools that are managed by the city or by the county or by your local township or municipality? Right. We, just for the sake of getting a sample of what was happening, we looked at pools in Allegheny County that were managed by the city and by the county, and then in Westmoreland County, a sample of pools that were operated by various municipalities. And the oversight does extend beyond those pools, so to hotel pools or to school pools, pools that might be in an apartment complex. The county health department in Allegheny County and the state are also looking at those pools. So there are hundreds of more pools that benefit or don't benefit from this oversight.
About 600 pools in Allegheny County alone. If the pool is not in your backyard, if it's at the hotel, if it's at the gym where you work out, it's supposed to follow these regulations.
Okay. Clarification, water turnover, are you talking about just going through the filtration process throughout the course of a day or hours or whatever, or is it draining, or is it just sort of the water sloshing about in different parts of the actual pool itself?
It's like if you've got some sugar in your tea,
okay,
and you just let it sink to the bottom. What the turnover means is you're supposed to take a spoon and stir it around so that it gets around the whole glass of tea. And it's the same concept for the pools. It's that the chlorine or the chemicals that they're using to clean the water is supposed to turn and churn throughout the whole pool. And it takes several hours for that to take place. Even if they're shocking it, it takes, depending on the size of the pool, it can take 4 to 6 hours.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Tribune Review reporters Nicole Brambilla and Jamie Martinez about their investigative reporting on health inspections of swimming pools in the region. Jamie, I want to start with you on this one. So where does the buck stop? Who is ultimately responsible for making sure the water condition and the surrounding area of the pools are safe?
Ultimately, it's the pool operators who are on site day to day. These are people who are taking those hourly tests or those two times a day tests. Those are the people who are collecting samples and sending them off to a lab on a weekly basis and keeping all the paperwork in check. In Allegheny County, county health inspectors are coming in and providing that oversight. If you don't have a local health department, maybe the state is coming in, maybe it's not.
The majority of counties across the Commonwealth do not have a health department. So Allegheny is among the select few. There are like 6 counties and 4 municipalities across the Commonwealth that do. So the majority of the state doesn't have this oversight. For example, the area, the Southwest District, that is being inspected has one state inspector. It includes Allegheny County and 10 other counties, also Westmoreland. That one inspector that by themselves is responsible for more than 1,000 pools.
And the state did tell us that if they receive complaints or if they hear about issues with the pool, they prioritize those pools for inspections. But it's a huge workload for a very small amount of resources.
Your report cited serious violations, critical violations. Briefly, what constitutes a critical violation?
It comes down to water quality, because you can get sickened, and depending on if you have a weakened immunity, it could be it could cost you your life. I mean, those are very rare examples, but critical findings almost always have to do with water quality.
And what happens, Jamie, when a critical violation is found?
It depends on the nature of the critical violation. If it's serious enough, it could shut down a pool. That happens every so often. They have to shut down for a couple days, correct the water quality issue. Sometimes it has to do with a broken piece of equipment. So Nicole mentioned water turnover. If filtration pumps aren't working properly, if something breaks or goes out of commission and they can't operate the filters, that would be a critical violation.
And shutdown could result in a draining of the pool?
It depends on what.
Normally, it's like shocking the pool.
Yeah, shocking the pool, okay. Cleaning. Yeah. If there's a case where a kid has an accident in the pool, they've got to clear the pool, shut it down, and clear that out. It really depends on the nature of what's happening.
And we found at least two closures, which our report mentions, where that was the case. I mean, one of the other things that was really interesting is how many times some of these pools are being caught with violations, and then how critical those violations are. So when inspectors went out, about half the time the pools were okay, but half the time they weren't. And when they weren't okay, 40% of the time they were critical findings.
You spoke with Kurt Huber, is it, from City Parks? What's his big concern?
It's what's getting in the pool. And, you know, the city operates 18 pools, and at any given time, they don't know what people are jumping in with on their bodies. So if you are doing yard work and then you go home, you take a shower, you put hairspray in your hair, you put deodorant on, and
sunscreen,
and then you jump in your local swimming pool, all of that is getting into the pool. And when those, you know, chemicals that you have on your body, like soaps and things, interact with the chemicals that are in the pool, it could diminish the effectiveness of those bacteria fighting chemicals that are in the pool. And, you know, that makes pool operators' jobs tough. That said, they're aware of it and constantly correcting. If it's a high volume day, if there are a lot of people coming in and out of the pool, they're
making
it.
If it's hotter, the temperatures can evaporate the chlorine.
They are doing everything they can to try and adjust for these things, but it makes their job tough.
We have just a couple minutes left. You mentioned have an accident in the pool, but also about people not bathing before they actually go swimming.
Right. Things like dirt or sweat can also have the same effect as, you know, some of those other chemicals and soaps and things you have.
It's as critical as not swimming, the old wives' tale, not swimming for an hour after you eat. You should be rinsing off before you get in the pool to wash away some of that nastiness so that the chlorine in the pool can be doing its job.
All right. Very quickly, you also spoke to infectious disease experts. I mean, what is the major concern here?
I mean, they brought up an interesting point that, you know, we're asking about pools today, but whether or not a county has a local health department checking in on the public could have implications if you're talking about other infectious diseases or other outbreaks. So today it's pools, something kind of fun and could be light, but this difference in oversight could have
far-reaching
implications.
Any tips for our listeners to assess by sight whether their local pool is safe this summer?
You can actually know by smelling. If you smell a lot of chlorine, then that's actually chemicals in the pool overreacting to all the junk that's in it. So if the pool smells like strong chlorine, that means the water's nasty. Or if it's cloudy, then obviously.
Right. If you can't see the bottom, don't jump in. Ask somebody what's going on. And then also keep in mind, a lot of pools sell bathing diapers. So if you don't have bathing diapers, purchase one at the entrance.
Yeah, regular diaper's not going to cut it.
They're a little leaky. And then just rinse off before you jump in. You can help keep everybody cleaner.
And don't pee in the pool.
Yes, don't pee in the pool. Just a sentence or two. Pittsburgh City Pools open June 12th. How are you going to be following up in the coming weeks?
We have a right to know out for some other issues that can happen around pools that people would want to know about. So look for something on Trip Live later in the summer.
And Jamie, what question or two do you really want answered that you still haven't found yet?
I would say just what are lifeguards? What are some of the requirements around them? And how else can they keep kids from? Keep kids safe over the summer.
How can we beef up this oversight?
Wow. Yeah.
Jamie Martinez and Nicole Bambila are reporters for the Tribune Review. Thanks so much for your reporting. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, how do we erase a $71 billion shortfall in the state's pension obligations? Has the state been pushing it down the road too long? And how will this affect taxpayers? If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.